Music from Michael Carr. That's from The Hidden Face of God, the song To a Broken God, a song of laments that he recorded, five, 6 years ago. Michael Carr, To a Broken God. 59 degrees under clear skies here in the Lake Country of East Dakota. It's 12 and a half minutes past the hour, and it's Wednesday, and best of all, Doug Greenwald has joined us from Columbia, Maryland. Doug, good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, guys. I just want to let you know we have slept with the windows open on the bedroom the last two nights here in Washington, D.C.
Oh, what does that mean, that it's cooled off a bit?
Yeah, that means it gets like in the mid-60s at night here the last couple of days, and hardly even into the 80 degrees for the high. So
it's got to feel like a reprieve of sorts here, unless it's turning to fall already. That's always on our minds in Minnesota come early August, because there have been years when it was clear that summer was over and done with, even before the tomatoes came in, which is perturbing to all of us up here. So we're hoping yet for some warmth this year. Texas is getting hot today, Oklahoma, so there's more real heat west of you, and presumably headed in your direction, so it could back up on you a little bit. Doug is the senior teaching fellow and executive director of Preserving Bible Times. It's a ministry based near Washington there that really is hard at work reconstituting, for many of us at least, unfortunately not most of us, yes, but we're working on it, the original context, the cultural and historic context of Scripture, so that we can understand it in its full dimension. And Doug has just been a delight for us now for, it's been 2 years, Doug. We've been on the air for 2 years.
Well, actually, isn't it 3 years this October, or am I wrong on
that? No, 2 years. This is, we're just our second end. In fact, Dave and I did the first morning show on Broken Road in August of 2010.
Okay.
Wait a second. No, 2011 it would have been. So it has been 2 years.
Congratulations.
Well,
it is.
Both survived.
Years.
Yeah. While we've been talking on the radio, you've been traveling the country doing seminars at churches, and you've given birth to something that you call the Institute of Biblical Context, and just did a successful week in Colorado Springs with a lot of biblical teachers from around the country. You've been in prison several times, and you're headed back, I understand.
As a guest, my name.
Oh, yeah, we should specify that. Doing context things with prisoners, and you find that a particularly receptive audience, don't you?
Well, I do. I think one of the things we lose sight of is how much time brothers in the prisons have on their hands. The last time I was out in a Kansas State prison, some of the brothers told me they had 5 and 6 hours a day to study, I mean, with nothing to do. So they decided to study the Scriptures. Now, what I also began to realize is there's very little guidance given to brothers in prison, brothers in blue, about what to study. And so I found a lot of brand new believers, they discovered Christ, found him, Christ sought them out, depending on how you look at that. In the last 2 to 3 years, they've really gotten excited about Bible study, and almost all of them were off in some sort of, I'll call it, tangential Bible study. One brother came up to me and said, how did I view numerology? Because he'd been studying numerology intensively for the last year, and I sort of cautioned him to maybe he wanted to study Jesus intensively for some time before perhaps looking into some of those kinds of subjects. Ran across another brother who was just consumed with prophecy, and he'd only been a believer for 18 months and really hadn't spent that much time in the Gospels. And so, it's a concern to me that the Spirit of God moves in prisons and they get excited and they want to dig into the Word of God, but there's little direction, there's little guidance given to keep them, camping terms, due north on the compass, to keep them from majoring in minors and to make sure they don't put the emphasis on the wrong syllable. And so one of the reasons I like to go into a prison is we can leave them, teach them frameworks, and obviously leave those frameworks behind about how to major in the majors and how to always keep your eyes open for the five main storylines of Scriptures and those kinds of things, because it's very easy with all the time on their hands and lack of oversight, spiritual oversight, they can start moving, positioning themselves towards ditches on both sides of the road, but not stay in the median.
Well, you know, you mentioned things that, that are common pitfalls to baby Christians. And newly acquainted with a spiritual life, it's easy to be sidetracked, to be captivated by things like prophecy and some of those flashy kinds of aspects of it. It's kind of like those lambs in a flock being susceptible to predators. And so it's good that you're there, because the church isn't fulfilling that responsibility. I mean, that's what it's there for. That's what our community of believers is supposed to be doing, is nurturing these new believers. And if they're in prison, they're away from the mainstream, and I can see the risk there. You're doing something else, though, that could help. And speaking of sheep and flocks, you've got a new book that came out today.
Actually, I think the first 4,000 copies get dropped off here in about 2 hours. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a brand new book. It's an unusual book. I never planned to write it, but several years ago, I developed a relationship with a lady named Marlene Lefevre, who was involved in David C. Cook's global mission. David C. Cook may not be a familiar word to you, but in the children's Sunday school world, they're the original publisher of Sunday school materials. I think they've been around like 130 years. So they're kind of a household word there. And they've been focused on kids for all that period of time. And whatever profits they make from their publishing business of Sunday school materials, they invest in missions. And several years ago, Marlene was tasked with trying to find out what new adventure in missions David C. Cook should pursue. And she traveled around Asia. And when she got to India, she discovered that there are 20,000 orphanages in India with youngsters in them, ages 7 through 12, probably. And all of them are orphans because they have only one parent, and that parent is either in the sex trade or in some related somehow to the drug business, so that they essentially have no parents. And their single parent is just unable to take care of them. And she asked them, and the orphanage people who run the orphanages, what can we do to help you? And what they really said they needed was lessons, Bible study lessons for kids that were fun and innovative. And so she came back to the States, and I happened to run across her again on one of my trips to Colorado, and she was telling me about this. And she said to me, would I be interested in writing a couple of lessons about what it was like to be a 12-year-old child in Israel in the first century? And I thought, well, that's an intriguing thought. But at the same time, I said to myself, what in the world would I write about? I don't know how to write to 12-year-olds. Anyway, I just felt I needed to say yes to that. So I started, you know, doing some research. And I ended up writing two lessons for what I hoped would be 12-year-old level, which I've come to realize, by the way, is the level of USA Today, the way they write. So,
I was just thinking, yeah, you're not far off the mark there.
So I thought, you know, it's not so bad to write for 12-year-olds. Not that I know how to do it, but at least I could give it a try. And I put two lessons together about what it was like to be a 12-year-old in the first century, and they really were well-received by the kids. So a year later, Marlene connected with me. She says, would I be interested in doing some more lessons for kids for the orphanage program out in Asia? And I thought, well, sure. And I don't know. I guess the Holy Spirit gave me the thought. I said, how about I write something about shepherding in the first century from the perspective of a 12-year-old boy who is learning shepherding from his father on the Judean hills? And she really liked that idea, so I went off and started to work on that material. And over time, I was able to finish that and pass that along to her. And then her crew surrounded that material with arts and crafts and puppet lessons and plays to act out and so forth, and sent them off to India. And in a second phase pilot program. And about a year or so ago, the feedback started to come in. Those lessons were really, really well received. They were the favorites of the kids. And so I was really pleased with that. And I also decided to share some of these lessons written for 12-year-old kids with adults. And I probably have never written material that got more well-received and more affirming feedback than those lessons once I put them under adult eyes.
Well, you know, we've talked about them here, sheep and shepherding in first century Israel and drawing parallels to life, and in particular our walks with Jesus. And just it's been a very fruitful time with you here on the air. And now the book is coming out. I'm looking at a copy of it here. We have an electronic version here. And just so folks know who are listening, we're going to make this available on our website at no charge. I've got to work hard to get it up on the website. It's going to take me a couple days to do that. But it'll be available on the website. And it's kind of the preview. But now you've got 4,000 copies coming. There goes the second bedroom, huh?
Well, fortunately, we have a two-stall garage. But to finish off that thought,
yeah.
About 6 months ago, I contacted Marlene on another subject. And she said, Doug, do you have any idea what's happened to those lessons? And I said, no. She said, well, I forget how many tens of thousands of people now in India had been exposed to it, but it has spread to Uganda, where the Anglican Church in Uganda has taken over that program, and they're going to be making it available to 5 million orphans in
My
Uganda.
Goodness. Hmm.
It's spilled over into Zambia. It's spilled over into other Asian countries. And she says, we're gearing up for 10 million kids to read that material.
My goodness.
Wow.
And that's what I said that, I mean, my jaw dropped and said I had no idea. And then I just felt prompted, you know, share it with adults. And so I put it into book form. It didn't change the copy at all. I did change the questions at the end of each chapter, more adult-oriented questions. And I've got a designer, and we whipped the thing together, and it's coming off press today. And I'm about to do something different that I've never done before with the book. As best I can, I want to make it what I call a giveaway book.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to price it low enough that anyone would be willing to buy it. In other words, that price is not an issue. And then to price quantity purchase of the books in such a way that you can hardly afford, that is, if you like the book, not to buy more and just give it away to whoever.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I mean, if a church wants to buy 100 of these books, I can get the price under $3 each.
My goodness.
If they want to buy 500 of these books to give away, I can get the price under $2 each. And so that's what I'm planning to do, is to have set a very, very low price, have very, very aggressive quantity pricing, and encourage people to give it away. Give it away to visitors who come to your church. Give it away to your staff. Give it away to all the volunteers in your Sunday school program. If you're in the youth ministry, give it to each one of the kids in the youth ministry, you know, however the Holy Spirit would lead. So I'm really intrigued to see where this might go. Now, freeze that thought, because in this giveaway mentality, I thought to myself, I wonder if I can give it away to pastors. Now, I happen to be involved on something called LinkedIn. Yeah, you familiar with that thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're part of that, yeah.
LinkedIn. I've got over 500 pastors that are linked in with me, you know, in my network. So 3 days ago, I crafted a little one paragraph kind of thing, said this new book is coming out. Here's what it is. If you'd like an absolutely free copy, just tell us where to send it. And I sent it off to 100. I call it my beta test, my 100 pastors. I know they're all pastors because of the titles.
Mm-hmm.
And how many responses do you think I've gotten so far?
What? 7.
I couldn't guess. I'm hoping a bunch.
Zero.
Oh, so my estimate of 7 is a little high.
We yeah, have a close winner with David.
Yeah.
So you know, I don't know if give it away is going to work. It may be clear to me. One group I can't give it away to are pastors.
I'm thinking lots of thoughts here that scare me a little bit, but you know, that's the response that a lot of pastors give to new information. It's like they're in their groove, and anything that's new that introduces maybe a new path to follow just gets no time from them. They're busy people. They've got all kinds of emotional commitments, and sometimes they're also in what we might call lovingly a rut. And I think that might be the core of the problem here. Becoming a Judean Shepherd is the name of the book, and it'll appear on the Broken Road Radio website in electronic form. It's a PDF file, and if you can't read PDF publications or forms, you can always download the Adobe Player. It's free. And then you can read this on your computer. They also have Android apps and so forth. So you can put it on your cell phones and your pads of various kinds. And Doug, we would be pleased to help get the word out on this book in any way we can. If you can send along some hard copies, too, I think we'll probably distribute those to some churches and let people know that we have them in our neck of the woods here as well. So,
it reminds me of, this is sort of tongue-in-cheek humor, but back when I was in business school in the late 60s, we were reading a bunch of case studies, and we read a case study about Parker Pens. Remember Parker Pens?
Oh,
I'm
yes.
not sure they're around anymore.
Well, I do remember them.
But they came out with something called the Parker T-Ball Jotter.
Yes, I remember it.
Mm-hmm. Late 60s.
Little dimpled ball on the end of your pen there. Yep.
Yeah, and so then they decided to come out with a premium version of it that they were going to price at $1.95, and it just didn't work. So they repriced it at $9.95, and it took off like gangbusters.
Yeah.
So maybe the fallacy in my thinking here is in trying to give it away for free, probably people may think it isn't worth much.
Well, I guess that's possible. and you've learned that lesson, too, with the Bible Alive seminars, that you don't give it away. People, if they don't have something invested, aren't going to come for the first session, and they'll never know what they're missing. But when they've committed, $20, $25, $30, whatever it happens to be in that locale, they'll come and listen. And I have, you did one in our area here back in April, and I've heard the glow is still here. People just thankful for what you brought them, and not a complaint about a dime wasted anywhere.
Well, so, praise the Lord for that.
Yeah. Now, there's another book that's out on the bestseller list that you mentioned to me, and David's acquainted with it. I'm not. Tell us about this book.
Well, this is, maybe we should label this morning A Tale of Two Books, but this is about another book. It overnight became the number one bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list. It's written by a Muslim, and it's about Jesus. And it's titled Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, which is a takeoff, by the way, on Alfred Edersheim's book, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, he combines truths with half-truths with no truths, and sort of a sensationalistic approach to the life of Jesus. Among such things is he makes claims that Jesus saw himself as a zealot.
Uh-huh.
And then he... You know, which isn't too far off.
Now,
the
when
mark.
You say zealot, are you using the generic term or the term that applies to the group, the zealots?
In well, see, he's using it generically, meaning one who shows zeal.
Uh-huh, okay.
Where technically and contextually, it means a following of people who were killing Roman soldiers to honor God, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's indicative of the kind of blurring of lines that takes place. And he says such things as Jesus never saw himself as God. He isn't God. When he said, I am Messiah, he was simply declaring himself to be in the lineage of David, who was going to be, and therefore he was going to be the next earthly king. Now, there's a half-truth there. The people thought that Messiah was going to be an earthly king who would bring peace, prosperity, and social justice to the land, okay? But that doesn't mean that's how Jesus saw himself. So there's another line that gets blurred there. And then he makes such wild statements as the disciples were illiterate. Well, technically, if you mean they didn't write Hebrew, he may be correct. I mean, that's why they had scribes. Scribes knew how to write. But if he meant illiterate, we're not familiar with the Old Testament scriptures, nothing could be further from the truth. Just all the men knew their scriptures incredibly well in that period of time. Anyway, he is the talk of TV. He's the number one bestseller overnight on the New York Times bestseller list. The Washington Post had three articles on him this past weekend. The thing has just gone viral. And so isn't it fascinating that if you make up truths and take half-truths and sensationalize a story about Jesus, you can sell hundreds of thousands of copies. But if you tell the real story of Jesus, which is equally fascinating and equally radical, it's hard to give it away.
Except the real story is much more challenging to us, each of us personally, because it invites, first of all, a belief and acceptance and a following that the untruth part doesn't. So the untruth part is sensational, it's fun, and it like you said, could go viral very easily. The positive thing in all this is that people still respond to any opportunity they can get to learn about Jesus. That makes them susceptible to falsehoods. There's danger in that, treachery in that. But the fact that there is interest there is still encouraging to me.
What I'd love to say to people who've read Aslan's book, if you think you're fascinated with the real Jesus, let me take you to him.
Yeah.
I've got some stuff you can read that will just take your breath away and drop your jaw and leave you stunned.
Well, see, I'm not sure how big this book is, but I suspect it's a quick and easy read.
I do not know the answer to that.
I don't know that it's a scholarly work. I don't know. I've not seen it, but I'd kind of like to get a hold of a copy and kind of judge for myself here on the motives behind this thing.
$13 on Amazon.
$13 paperback, probably?
$13. No, that's the hardcover.
Oh, hardcover. Okay.
That's the hardcover. The for whatever reason, you can buy a used copy for $15. I don't know. It depends upon which part of Amazon you look for, but it's and I'm trying to find the number of pages in the book, and there's a sample on it. The Aslan is a creative writing professor in UC Santa Barbara. He's gone to Harvard Divinity School, but you know and his doctorate involved or was titled The History of Religion, and he's represented himself as an historian.
Also fascinating here is he was raised by an atheistic father and a Muslim mother. Mm-hmm. He accepted Christ as an evangelical in his teens. He walked away from it and re-embraced Islam later in life, and now he's writing it as a Muslim. So he's had his own journey as a religious study major. But what's going to intrigue me, and I say that almost sadly, is how many church small groups are going to decide this is worthy now of study.
Mm-hmm. That would be a concern.
Have you read the book, Doug?
I have not.
Oh, okay. I'm curious about reading it. It's got, as Amazon always does, it's got samples of pages inside, but
well, Doug, the thought occurs to me, should we be leery of this? I mean, should Christians not read it, or should Christians read it and deal with it?
Well, my preconceived notion about any field of study is you should read as much as you possibly can. You should learn everything you possibly can and make up your mind.
And learn to discern.
Yeah, you should develop the skill of, or the skill, or at least the effort toward thinking on your own feet, and stop parroting the phrases of those people around you.
But in a culture where the real Jesus is actually rather alien to the way we think and act every day, and the sensational Jesus might just fit right in and be comfortable. I'm leery of that comparison, that dialectic. Doug?
If there's one ability that seems to be an awfully short supply these days in the evangelical church, it is the capacity or the gift of discernment. Mm-hmm. And so when you read something that's half truth and half error, half fiction, how can you discern the difference if you've not taught to be a discerning reader?
So you think the book should not get so much publicity, or should maybe just certain people deal with it? How do we
recommend? Well, I don't know what to make of this. I'm not trying to sit in judgment over this. You know, the Spirit of God may well take this misguided enthusiasm for rediscovering Jesus and channel it into authenticity. I have no idea. It could prompt some people to go deeper, but if they want to go deeper and discover the real Jesus of the Gospels, do they even know where to go?
Yeah, good question. Good question.
It's curious that that the stories you hear about the book tend to be from the liberal media. You know, he writes for the Daily Beast, among one of the other things that he does is in his part time. He's on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's on something called the Friends Committee. He writes for the New York Times, Slate, Boston Globe, Washington Post, The Guardian, and the Chicago Tribune. Not the Washington,
Times.
Yeah, the Times. He doesn't write for any conservative magazines or newspapers that I can see. He's made appearances on National Public Radio, PBS, The Rachel Maddow Show, Meet the Press, Daily Show, Colbert Report, and Anderson Cooper. But I don't see his name listed on as being interviewed by Sean Hannity or anybody from the right, all from the left. Fareed Zakaria, Real Time with Bill Maher.
He knows the market for his books.
Yeah, I mean, this seems like he's got a preconceived notion about who's going to buy his books, and that's where he goes to sell them. Mm-hmm. I would like to read it from the standpoint of examining what you're talking about, Doug, to see if I can see them as well. My knowledge of first century Hebrew is not even close to that, but not even close to what yours is. But there should be some things in there jump out at me and say, wait a minute, that even close to what I've heard before, what I've learned before. And then I would go back to the original source to see if somebody is making something up.
Yeah, some interesting thoughts there, Doug.
Yeah, did you see the Fox News broadcast of the interview with Lauren Green?
No, but I heard it was pretty aggressive.
Yeah, and it's online. It's and she took him to task quite a bit, and she asked some of these very specific questions, and he says in the introduction in his book that he became a Christian at 15, but then ignores or doesn't say that he returned to Islam when he was in his 20s. Just things that he leaves out. And I've only seen bits and pieces of the interview. And Green said, asked him, he said that you present yourself as an historian, but you have no degrees in history. It's probably fine if you have a reputation as an historian, like Jim mentioned earlier, David McCullough. Now, David McCullough's academic history is in English, and he was always a writer. Now, he's become an historian because of the works that he's produced, but this guy hasn't produced anything on history. He's produced.
I think it's significant that he teaches creative writing.
Yeah, uh-huh. I think so too.
Well, interesting topics here, and we're talking two books here. First is Doug's new book, Becoming a Judean Shepherd, and again, it's going to be available from preservingbibletimes.org. That's Doug's website, the ministry's website. You can link there from ours, brokenroadradio.com, and over the next few days, look for Doug's book to appear on our website as well, where you can download an electronic version. And Doug, this is just exciting for you, and you're out doing combat for us. You really are.
Well,
and I think of those millions of kids. I mean, that's important work.
Yeah, I think the Sword of the Spirit certainly precedes is leading the charge out there. Mm-hmm. But it thrills me that there are hundreds of thousands of orphans getting exposed to this kind of a view of God their Father, who's the Good Shepherd. Mm-hmm.
Doug Greenwald, again, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. Doug, as always, it's been a joy to have you on the air with us, and we'll look for. Are you going to be available next week? You're a busy guy.
Actually, I am deep on a beach in the southeast part of the country, and essentially unreachable for next week.
And no Michigan trip this summer, huh?
What's that?
No Michigan trip this summer?
Well, this is the, you know, we're no longer go to the cottage in Michigan. Okay. We sold it. And so now the kids wanted to go to Hilton Head Island on the beach there. So I'm in for a real culture shock, as you East Dakotans know. You know, go from fresh water to salt water.
And of course, we don't have grits.
Heat versus cool. And so we'll see how it all goes.
And we rarely eat grits for breakfast up here either. So get ready
for
that.
Well, shrimp and grits, if it's done well, is really a good feed.
Doug, thanks so much. Doug Greenwald, Preserving Bible Times. Music now from Avalon.